Everyone knows the name Lindbergh, the spirit of St. Louis. May 1927, New York to Paris, 33 and a half hours, alone across the Atlantic. Everybody knows that story. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today I want to talk about the two men who did something remarkably similar 8 years before Lindbergh, in an open cockpit biplane, through weather that spent most of the night trying to kill them, with a navigator who climbed out onto the engine in the dark 6 times with a knife to chip ice off the air intakes by hand, and somehow most people have never heard their names. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com, June 1919. The Great War had been over for 7 months. The armistice was signed, but Europe was still trying to find its footing. A whole generation of young men had learned to fly, not for adventure but for survival, and quite a few of them weren't ready to come home and go back to selling hardware or working in an office. The London Daily Mail had first offered a prize of £10,000 for the first non-stop transatlantic crossing by aeroplane back in 1913. Then the war happened. When the shooting finally stopped, the prize came back on the table, and aviators started circling it like they could smell blood in the water. £10,000 in 1919 was real money, probably something in the neighborhood of $500,000 in today's terms, but honest to goodness, the money almost wasn't the point. The Atlantic was the point. The last great uncrossed distance in the air. Several teams converged on Newfoundland in the spring of 1919. Harry Hawker and Kenneth Mackenzie Grieve had already tried and failed in May in a sop with aircraft. Their engine overheated somewhere over the mid-Atlantic. They ditched in the ocean, were picked up by a Danish steamer, and the world thought they were dead for 7 full days before the news arrived that they'd survived. Frederick Raynham and his navigator Morgan crashed on takeoff at Quiddy Vidi Lake and never made it into the air. There was a Handley Page team with a massive bomber that ran into delays and never got off the ground at all. Into all of this walked John Alcock and Arthur Witten Brown. Alcock was 26 years old. Royal Naval Air Service veteran, he'd been flying since 1912, which in the early days of powered flight meant he had more hours than almost anyone. He'd been shot down over Turkey in 1917 while leading a bombing mission, spent 2 years as a prisoner of war, and spent most of those 2 years thinking about what he was going to do when the war ended. The answer was simple: fly, farther than anyone ever had. Arthur Witten Brown was 32, Royal Flying Corps observer and navigator. He'd been wounded seriously enough that he walked with a limp for the rest of his life. He'd also been captured. He was a quieter man than Alcock, methodical, a mathematician at heart who happened to find himself in aeroplanes during the war and turned out to be exceptionally good at knowing where he was in the sky. They made a sensible team. Alcock was the instinctive stick and rudder man. Brown was the one with the sextant and the tables and the patience to do spherical trigonometry with frozen hands and a bouncing aircraft. They arrived in St. John's in late May to prepare. Their aircraft was a Vickers Vimy. The Vimy was a biplane built for war, designed as a strategic bomber, intended to hit Berlin if the war had lasted long enough. It had a wingspan of 68 feet, 2 open cockpits up front, and was powered by a pair of Rolls-Royce Eagle engines, each producing about 360 horsepower. Not a nimble machine, not a graceful machine, it was a biplane with the aerodynamics of a freight car, honest and heavy and functional. They stripped out the bomb bay and filled it with extra fuel tanks. 865 gallons of petrol for the crossing. Fully loaded, the aircraft weighed close to 13,000 pounds. Finding a suitable runway in Newfoundland in 1919 wasn't straightforward. They ended up carving a field out of rough ground near Lester's Field outside St. John's, filling soft spots with gravel, pulling wire across uneven patches to flatten them. 6 weeks of preparation for 16 hours of flying. By June the 14th, the barometer said conditions were as good as they were going to get. In the North Atlantic in any season, that means marginally acceptable and likely deteriorating. They took it. They climbed in at roughly 1:30 in the afternoon, Alcock in the left seat, Brown beside him. They had sandwiches and coffee in flasks. They had electrically heated flying suits, which was actually fairly advanced for 1919. They had a sextant, celestial tables, charts, and Brown's ability to run the mathematics in his head. They also had, briefly, a radio. The Vimy ran up its eagles, that deep heavy thrumming of big piston engines at full power, and lumbered down the rough field. 13,000 pounds wanting to fly, the tail came up slowly. The nose dropped toward the horizon, and they cleared the far fence with just enough altitude to make it interesting and not enough to be comfortable. They dropped toward the water, built airspeed, and turned east. Within the first hour, the radio failed. The wind-driven vane that powered the transmitter was damaged in the slipstream and stopped turning. From that moment forward, they were silent. Nobody could hear them. If they went into the ocean, the world would know what they were attempting, but not what had happened. They flew on. The first hours were clear enough for Brown to work. He shot the sun with the sextant, worked out their position against the tables, made corrections to the heading. The sea below was dark green and gray, white-capped, empty. The Rolls-Royce Eagles settled into cruise, eating through their 865 gallons at a steady rate. When darkness came, Brown switched to the stars. This wasn't simple navigation. The bubble sextant had to be held level while he measured star altitude. The aircraft was bouncing in turbulence, and the cockpit light was barely enough to read the tables. He got fixes anyway. Not precise by modern standards. Close enough to know they were on course. Sometime around 2 in the morning, they flew into cloud. There's a thing that happens when you lose the horizon in the dark. Any pilot who has trained for instruments knows what's coming when I say this. Spatial disorientation. The inner ear lies to you. You feel wings level when you're in a bank. You feel coordinated when you're in a spiral. The body has no way to know the difference between gravity and centrifugal force in a sustained turn. It happened to Alcock. The Vimy entered an uncontrolled spiral dive. He couldn't see the wings. He couldn't see the horizon. The aircraft was in a near-vertical bank, nose down, airspeed building fast. The altimeter was unwinding, like a clock someone had kicked. They punched out of the bottom of the cloud, still turning and diving, and the surface of the North Atlantic was right there, right underneath them, close enough to see the wave faces in the dark. Alcock pulled out level with something close to 50 feet of clearance. Neither man said much about that moment afterward. Some things don't have words that fit them. He pulled the nose back up, climbed back into the cloud, and they kept flying east. Because what else do you do? Now here's where it gets interesting. The icing started not long after. The Rolls-Royce Eagle engines breathed through air intake scoops on the nacelles, and ice was building on those scoops, choking the airflow, making the engines surge and run rough. One engine losing power over the Atlantic in 1919 was serious. Losing both was a different kind of serious. Brown climbed out of the cockpit. Pull up a chair and think about what that actually means. They're at altitude over the North Atlantic. It's the middle of the night. The outside air temperature is at or below freezing. The aircraft is making close to 100 miles per hour, and Brown is out of his seat, out of the open cockpit, working his way along the exterior of the fuselage toward the engine nacelles with a knife in his hand. He chipped the ice off the intake scoops, cleared the airflow, climbed back in. He did that 6 times before dawn. 6 times he went out into the slipstream in the cold and the dark, worked his way to the engine, chipped ice with a knife, and came back. On one of those trips, he lost his footing and grabbed a fuel gauge pipe that was sticking up through the wing to catch himself. He held on, found his balance, kept going. At some point in the night, an instrument cracked from the cold. Brown leaned over to examine it, felt something warm on his hand in the dark. He looked down. Blood. The cracked glass had opened his palm. He wrapped it with part of his scarf and went back to the tables. Dawn came around 4 in the morning at that latitude in June. Gray first, then a long red line along the eastern horizon. After 8 hours of cloud and dark and spiral dives and icing and ice chips and a bleeding hand, that light must have looked like something close to a promise kept. They had been in the air for roughly 15 hours. The fuel numbers were tight but workable. If Ireland was where Brown's calculations said it was, they had enough. And then out of the morning haze off the nose appeared the coast of County Galway. Alcock spotted what looked like a solid flag green field near Clifton Town and brought the Vimy down. From altitude, it looked ideal, level, green, open. He set up an approach and put it down. What neither of them knew until the wheels touched was that the green field was Derrigemlog Bog. The wheels sank immediately into the peat. The tail came up, the nose went down, and the Vimy buried its nose in the bog and stood there on its propeller tips with the tail in the air, like it had decided to take a final bow. The propellers were bent. The nose section was crumpled. Alcock and Brown climbed out. Neither was seriously hurt. Brown had bruised ribs. That was the worst of it. They stood in the Irish mud, in the early morning of June 15, 1919, and looked at each other across the wreckage. 16 hours and 27 minutes. 1900 miles, nonstop. First crossing of the North Atlantic by aeroplane, done. Within hours, the news was out by telegraph. Winston Churchill, then Secretary of State for Air, presented the Daily Mail Prize personally. £10,000 in cash. Reporters showed up, crowds gathered, King George V knighted them both within weeks, Sir John Alcock, Sir Arthur Witten Brown. The Vickers Vimy would go on to other long-distance records. That same year, Ross and Keith Smith flew one from England to Australia. Pierre van Reineveld and Quinton Brand flew one from England to South Africa in 1920. The bomber that was built to end the war, and never used that way, turned out to be exactly the right machine for showing what the air could connect. And then 6 months after the Atlantic crossing, on December 18, 1919, John Alcock was delivering a Vickers Viking amphibious aircraft to the Paris Aero Show. He flew into fog over Normandy. He lost control in the murk. He was 27 years old. Brown was at the funeral. He never flew again after that. He went into engineering, married, lived a quiet life in Wales. He outlived his partner by nearly 30 years, dying in October of 1948. There's a monument at Derrigumlaug Bog today, a white stone cairn in the middle of the heather, out in the peat, with a view of the Atlantic on a clear day. Not many tourists find it. If you're ever in County Galway, it's worth a drive down the bog road to stand there for a minute. Here's what stays with me. Charles Lindbergh crossed the Atlantic in 1927 and became one of the most famous men of the 20th century. The spirit of St. Louis hangs in the Smithsonian. His name is in every aviation history book ever printed. I don't begrudge him any of that. What he did was genuinely extraordinary, and he carried it with grace for the rest of his life. But Alcock and Brown did it 8 years before him. Open cockpit, no autopilot, no attitude gyroscope worth trusting in cloud. Radio gone within the hour, a spiral dive to 50 feet over open ocean in the dark. A navigator climbing out onto the engine 6 times with a knife, a bog landing on a bent nose at the end of it. Lindbergh had an enclosed cockpit, a right whirlwind that didn't ice up, and 8 years of better aircraft design standing between him and what Alcock and Brown flew. What they did was at the very outer edge of what was conceivable in 1919, and they went out and did it anyway. I think about that when people tell me the golden age of aviation is behind us. The instinct that put Alcock in that cockpit that put Brown out on the nacelle in the dark that isn't behind us. It's in every test pilot who straps in for a first flight. It's in every bush pilot who launches into the Alaskan morning, not entirely sure what the weather is going to do. It's in every student on their first solo cross-country. Out of radio range for the first time, navigating by chart and compass and their own best judgment. The ocean is still out there, the distance is still real. My sources today include the historical archives of the Royal Aeronautical Society, the Daily Mail Transatlantic Prize Records, and Brendan Lynch's book Yesterday We Were in America, which covers this flight in the detail it deserves. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger, safe skies.